Imagine a completely legal loophole in the US tax code that allows a wealthy grandparent to just shield $190,000 from the IRS on a random Tuesday.
Right, just totally out of the blue.
Exactly. Or, a strategy that lets you buy a midlife crisis sports car completely tax penalty free at age 66 using money that was specifically designated for your healthcare.
Yeah, which sounds illegal, but it's absolutely not.
It's totally by the book. Today, we are cracking open the tax code because the rules aren't just rules. They are literally the blueprints for building or losing generational wealth.
Which is exactly why they test you so heavily on it.
For sure. But really quickly, before we jump completely into this material today, I want to mention that this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
They really are. If you are gearing up for the Series 65, they have this incredible full course setup. We're talking like adaptive study quizzes that actually figure out your weak spots, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real test.
It's essentially a cheat code for passing the exam.
It basically is. You can check it all out at certfuel.com. Anyway, let's get into the mission for today.
Let's do it.
So our goal today is conquering a very specific, honestly, very thorny section of the Series 65 exam, which is special types of accounts.
Right. Education accounts, custodial accounts, and healthcare accounts.
Yeah. And to give you some context on the exam weighting here, this material makes up about 2% of the test.
Which usually translates to around two or maybe three questions total.
Just two or three questions. But here is why we are spending a whole deep dive on this. These are not gimme questions.
Not at all.
They are highly specific, incredibly rule heavy, and I swear they are designed by evil geniuses to trip you up if you only have a surface level understanding.
Oh, absolutely. The test makers know exactly which rules overlap, they know which ones contradict each other, and they will test you right in those messy gray areas.
Yeah, that's where they get you.
So the mission today isn't just to, memorize flashcards. It's to deeply understand the underlying logic, the actual why behind the rule.
Because if you understand why the IRS wrote the rule the way they did, you will be able to recall the answer under the intense pressure of the exam center.
No matter how weird the hypothetical scenario gets.
Exactly. So here are the rules of engagement for our deep dive today. We know that standard, dry textbook lectures can make your brain completely shut off.
Especially if you were wrestling with ADHD
Yeah.
or just general study fatigue.
Right. We are definitely not doing that. Instead, we're going to introduce some truly bizarre scenarios. We are going to ask direct, pointed questions.
And when we hit a crucial concept, we might just pause and let you think about it.
Yeah. Because if you are sitting in the testing center, I mean, you want to trust your gut, but you also need to know where the test writers are waiting in the bushes to jump out at you.
Active recall is the goal here. It's about forcing your brain to engage with the material rather than just passively letting the words wash over you.
Right, because when you have to commit to an answer and actually puzzle through the mechanics, the rule sticks with you far longer.
It really does.
Okay, so to help these rules stick, I want to introduce you to our cast of characters for today. We are going to use these same fictional people in our scenarios so you can actually visualize what is happening in the real world of wealth management.
Having recurring characters makes it so much easier to track the rules.
Totally. So first up, we have Grandpa Gary. Grandpa Gary is highly affluent. He absolutely adores his family. And his defining personality trait is that he utterly despises paying taxes.
A classic high net worth client profile for a Series 65 candidate.
Oh, 100%.
He's the kind of client who will call you at 2 in the morning because he read an article about a tax loophole in a Forbes magazine and he wants to do it tomorrow.
Exactly. Next, we have Panicked Paul. Paul is an upper middle class dad. He is constantly stressed out. Yeah, he loses sleep worrying about whether his kid will qualify for financial aid. He worries about market crashes. And above all else, Paul is terrified of losing control of his money.
He wants to help his family, but he wants his hands firmly gripped on the steering wheel at all times.
Right. Which brings us to the beneficiary of all this financial anxiety, Skater Sally.
Yes, Sally is Paul's teenage daughter and Gary's granddaughter.
And she is a total wild card. Like, she might go to a four-year Ivy League college, she might go to a vocational trade school, or she might just turn 18, take all her college savings, and blow it on a fleet of custom skateboards and a touring van.
She is the variable that gives Panic Paul his panic.
Exactly. So with our cast assembled, let's look at the first vehicle these two men might use to save for Sally's future.
Let's start with the absolute Goliath of the education savings world.
We are talking about the 529 plan, which is officially known in the tax code as a qualified tuition program.
And what's fascinating here is that there are actually two distinct types of 529 plans, though. One has become far more common than the other over the last two decades.
Right. The ones you will see most often are 529 savings plans.
These operate very much like a regular mutual fund portfolio. You put the money in, you choose an investment track, often an age-based portfolio that gets more conservative as the kid gets closer to college age.
And the account value fluctuates with the stock and bond market.
Exactly.
So if the market tanks the year Sally goes to college, Paul is going to be panicking even more because that balance just dropped 20% right when tuition is due.
Precisely, which is why they originally created the other type, the prepaid tuition plan.
Okay, tell me about those.
Well, these are less common now, but they allow you to lock in current tuition rates at in-state public colleges. So if tuition is $10,000 a semester today, you pay that now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and even if it's $20,000 a semester when Sally finally enrolls in a decade, that semester is fully paid for. You are shifting the inflation risk entirely to the state.
That sounds like an amazing deal. Why are they less common now?
Because the states realized they were losing a ton of money.
Oh, right, because college costs exploded.
Exactly. Tuition costs started vastly outpacing the returns the states could get on the invested capital in those prepaid pools.
Right.
So a lot of states just closed them to new investors entirely.
That makes sense. But for the exam, you just need to know they exist and that they hedge against tuition inflation, whereas the savings plans carry market risk.
Right.
Okay, but let's focus on the mechanics of getting money into these accounts, the what and the how. Contributions to a 529 are always made with after-tax dollars, right?
Correct. You do not get a federal income tax deduction for putting money in.
Though, depending on where Paul lives, his state might toss him a state tax deduction as a little treat for using their specific plan.
Right. The federal government doesn't subsidize the input, only the growth and the output.
Got it.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture of contribution limits, 529s are incredibly generous.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there is no federal contribution limit whatsoever.
None, like at all.
None. But before Grandpa Gary backs up a dump truck full of cash and dumps $1 billion in, the states do set their own limits.
Ah, okay.
They do. These are aggregate limits, meaning the total maximum amount that can be in the plan for one beneficiary in that state.
And what are those numbers looking like?
For 2026, those limits typically range from $235,000 on the low end, all the way up to $529,000 per beneficiary per state plan.
Okay, so let me make sure I'm visualizing this correctly. I like to compare the 529 plan to a massive, incredibly exclusive VIP club.
I like this analogy.
Thanks. But here's the twist. There is no dress code, and there are absolutely no income limits to get in. If Panicked Paul makes $500,000 a year, the VIP club lets him right in.
Right.
If Grandpa Gary makes $2 million a year, he walks right in. Anyone can contribute, regardless of their modified adjusted gross income. But the state plays the role of the bouncer.
Okay, I see where you're going.
The bouncer doesn't care how much you make, but once you've brought, say, $500,000 of cash into the club for Skater Sally, the bouncer steps in, puts a hand on your chest, and says, okay, that's enough. She's fully funded.
That is a very apt way to visualize the lack of income limits, but the presence of an aggregate limit. The bouncer isn't looking at your W-2. He's just looking at the total cash sitting at Sally's table.
Exactly. Now, because these are after-tax contributions, they are treated as completed gifts to the beneficiary for gift tax purposes.
And this is where Grandpa Gary gets very interested, because he is obsessed with the annual gift tax exclusion.
Right. So in 2026, the annual gift tax exclusion is $19,000 per donor per beneficiary.
Meaning Gary can give Sally 19 grand this year, and the IRS doesn't even blink.
No gift tax, no reporting. It doesn't eat into his lifetime estate exemption.
Yeah.
But, I mean, 19 grand isn't going to satisfy Gary.
No, he wants to move serious wealth out of his taxable estate. And he wants to do it yesterday.
Exactly. Which brings us to one of the most highly testable, unique features of the 529 plan, the five-year election.
Also known in the industry as superfunding.
Okay, let's play this out and let the listener think about it. Imagine Grandpa Gary wants to dump a massive chunk of cash into Skater Sally's 529 plan right now, today, without triggering a single dime of gift taxes.
Okay.
I want you to think, how much can he legally give her in a single lump sum in 2026?
Let's give them a second to do the math.
Right.
So, well, let's break down the calculation. The IRS allows a contributor to a 529 plan to front load 5 years worth of the annual gift tax exclusion all at once.
All at once? That's crazy.
Yeah. So you take the 2026 limit of $19,000, multiply it by five, and you get $95,000. The IRS treats this lump sum as if it were being spread out evenly over the next 5 years.
So 95 grand from just him. But wait, what if Grandpa Gary is married to Grandma Gail and they agree to split the gift? Because they both have that exclusion, right?
Exactly. Then you just double it. 19,000 times 5 is 95,000 times two donors. They can drop $190,000 into Skater Sally's 529 plan on a Tuesday, completely shielding it from gift taxes.
Gary is doing backflips right now. He just moved almost 200 grand out of his taxable estate in one afternoon. But the IRS does require some paperwork for this magic trick, don't they?
Yes, they definitely do. To execute this superfunding strategy, Grandpa Gary must file IRS Form 709.
Which is the gift tax return, right?
Right. The United States Gift and Generation Skipping Transfer Tax Return in the year he makes the contribution. He has to formally declare to the IRS that he is making the five-year election.
So he isn't paying tax on it, but he has to report it so they can track the five-year clock.
Exactly.
Okay, but here is where the exam makers are sitting in a dark room, rubbing their hands together, setting up a scenario to catch you sleeping. Let's look at the actual mechanism of that five-year clock.
This is a tricky one.
Yeah. Grandpa Gary superfunds Skater Sally's account with his 95 grand. Year one goes by, everything is great. But in year two, tragically, Grandpa Gary passes away.
This is a classic distractor on the exam.
Right. So if I'm taking the test, my instinct is to think, well, the money's already in the account, so it's Sally's. But Gary didn't finish the 5 years, so maybe the IRS takes the money back out of the 529.
It's a good guess.
I want you to pause and think. What actually happens to that $95,000 that he supposedly gifted over 5 years?
Yeah, think about what the IRS cares about most.
Right.
So you are half right with your guess. The money itself stays in the 529 plan. Sally doesn't lose a dime of the actual cash.
Okay, so she's safe.
She is. However, for estate tax purposes, Grandpa Gary cannot cheat death and taxes simultaneously. Because he died in year two, only two-fifths of that money is considered a completed out-of-the-estate gift.
Oh, wow.
The remaining three-fifths, the pro rata share for the years he didn't live to see, is pulled right back into his taxable estate.
The ghost of Grandpa Gary is furious. The IRS reaches right back into his estate calculation and says, "Nice try, Gary, but you didn't survive the 5 years. We are taxing that remaining three-fifths as part of your estate."
Exactly. So three times 19,000.
Yeah.
$57,000 gets added back to his estate value.
It is such a specific rule, and it is incredibly testable because it requires you to understand the intersection of gift taxes, estate taxes, and education accounts.
Right. If the donor dies during the superfunding period, a pro rata share goes back into the donor's estate.
Got it. So we've covered getting the money in. Let's discuss what happens while it's in there and how you get it out. We said contributions are not federally tax deductible.
Right. They go in after tax.
But while that money sits in our VIP club, the growth is tax deferred. It grows and grows, compounding year over year, and you don't pay capital gains taxes.
Which is huge over an 18-year horizon.
Yeah. And if you use it for qualified expenses, it is completely tax-free federally.
Tax-free growth and tax-free withdrawals. But the definition of a qualified expense is where things get interesting, because Congress has expanded it significantly over the years.
Right. It is absolutely not just university tuition anymore.
Not at all.
Let's run through the list. College tuition and fees at eligible institutions. The textbook always says Title IV eligible. Let's pause there. What exactly does Title IV mean? Does that mean Sally can't use this money for a three-month coding boot camp in San Francisco or to get a yoga instructor certificate in Bali?
In almost all cases, no, she cannot use it for the yoga retreat. Title IV refers to the section of the Higher Education Act that dictates which institutions can process federal student aid.
So, if FAFSA stuff.
Exactly. If the school can accept FAFSA money, federal student loans, and Pell Grants, it is an eligible institution for 529 purposes. That includes almost all traditional colleges, community colleges, and many accredited trade schools.
But unaccredited boot camps or random international retreats usually do not qualify.
Right. They have to be accredited under that specific federal framework.
Okay, that makes sense. So tuition and fees are covered. What about room and board? Because rent is crazy expensive near college campuses.
Room and board is covered, but there's a major caveat here. To use 529 funds for room and board, Skater Sally must be enrolled at least half-time.
Oh.
Yeah. If she's taking one pottery class a semester, she can't use the 529 to pay her rent. And speaking of rent, the room and board expense is capped at the university's published allowance for the cost of attendance.
Ah, so if the university says average off-campus housing is 10 grand a year, Grandpa Gary can't rent Sally a $50,000 luxury penthouse and call it a qualified 529 expense just because she's in college.
Correct. The IRS caps it at the school's published figures.
Good to know.
Other qualified expenses include books, supplies, and equipment required for enrollment. Computer equipment, software, internet access, all totally fine as long as they are primarily used by the beneficiary during any of the years the beneficiary is enrolled at an eligible educational institution.
Okay, what about kids with special needs?
Yes, expenses for special needs beneficiaries are also fully covered.
And here is where the rules have broadened recently, making 529s much more versatile. You can now use 529 funds for K-12 education. This was a massive shift.
It was huge. This came out of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. The K-12 provision allows up to $20,000 per student per year to be withdrawn for elementary or secondary school expenses.
Wait, really? Panic Paul can use this for Sally's private high school.
He can. And under the current federal rules, that $20,000 cap covers a lot. Tuition, curricular materials, books, online educational materials, standardized test fees, dual enrollment fees, and even certain tutoring or educational therapies for students with disabilities.
That $20,000 limit per year for K-12 is crucial. That is a number to memorize. You can't take out 50 grand for an elite boarding school. You are capped at 20 grand.
Exactly.
So what if Sally finishes college and has some student loans from before the 529 was fully funded?
The Secure Act of 2019 expanded it again. You can use 529 funds to repay qualified student loans, up to a $10,000 lifetime limit per borrower.
Wait, lifetime limit, not per year, 10 grand total.
Correct, total lifetime limit. And finally, if Skater Sally decides college isn't her thing, she can use the funds for fees, books, supplies, and equipment for registered apprenticeship programs.
Okay, provided they are registered and certified with the Secretary of Labor under the National Apprenticeship Act.
Right, they can't just be some informal apprenticeship.
Got it. Okay, so that is a massive list of ways to use the money legally. But let's talk about why Panic Paul, out of all the accounts we will discuss today, absolutely loves the 529 plan more than anything else.
It comes down to two words, account control.
Yes, Paul is the account owner. Sally is merely the beneficiary. Sally never, at any age, gets the keys to this account.
Never.
When she turns 18, she doesn't get to demand the money. If Sally tells Paul she is skipping college to fund a skateboard tour, Paul can just cross his arms and say no. The money stays right where it is.
The account owner retains full legal control. Paul can decide when the money is distributed and to whom. If Sally refuses to go to school, Paul can change the beneficiary to another qualifying family member.
Really? Like who?
He could give it to Sally's younger brother. He could change it to a first cousin. He could even change the beneficiary to himself if he decides to go back and get his master's degree.
And there are no tax consequences for changing the beneficiary to another qualifying family member.
None whatsoever, as long as they are in the same family tree as defined by the IRS. This control is exactly why 529s are favored over certain types of irrevocable trusts for many families. It provides flexibility without relinquishing ownership.
That control is everything to Paul. But let's explore a dark timeline. What if Paul gets really mad? What if he says, forget it, nobody in this family is going to college. I am taking this money back to buy myself a speedboat. Can he do that?
He absolutely can. It's his account. But it will be a non-qualified withdrawal. And that triggers one of the most misunderstood mechanics in the tax code, which the exam will absolutely test you on.
Okay, let's break this down. Think about this carefully. Sally drops out to start a band. Paul is furious. He liquidates the entire $50,000 balance of the 529 account to buy a boat.
The boat of his dreams.
Yeah. Now, the money wasn't used for education. If I'm taking the exam, I might guess that the IRS is going to smash him with a penalty on their entire 50 grand because he broke the rules, right? So do they.
It is completely logical to think that, but no. He does not pay the penalty on the whole balance.
Explain why. What is the underlying mechanism here?
You have to remember how the money got into the account in the first place. Paul and Gary made after-tax contributions.
Oh, right.
That principal amount of money they originally deposited has already been taxed by the IRS. The IRS isn't going to tax you twice on your own principal just because you changed your mind about how to spend it.
That makes total sense.
Therefore, the ordinary income tax and the 10% penalty apply only to the earnings portion of the withdrawal.
Ah, only the growth. So let's do the math on this. If they put in $40,000 of their own money over the years and it grew to $50,000, the 10 grand of growth is the only part that gets hit.
Exactly.
So Paul pays his marginal income tax rate on that 10 grand, PLUS, a 10% penalty, which is $1,000 on that same 10 grand. The original 40 grand comes out completely tax-free and penalty-free because it was his money to begin with.
You nailed it. The 10% penalty on non-qualified withdrawals applies only to earnings, not principal. The exam will give you a scenario with a principal amount and an earnings amount and ask you to calculate the penalty. Always apply it only to the earnings.
Okay, let's look at one more feature of the 529 plan, and this came out of Secure 2.0. It is relatively new, and it is an absolute game changer. I call it the ultimate escape hatch.
It really is.
Let's say Sally doesn't drop out. Instead, she gets a full ride scholarship for her skateboarding skills. The 529 is fully funded, and there is 50 grand left over. Paul doesn't want to take the penalty to buy a boat, but he wants to do something useful with the money. What can he do?
He can utilize the 529 to Roth IRA rollover. This rule allows unused 529 funds to be rolled directly into a Roth IRA. But because this is the IRS, there are several very strict caveats and limits you must know for the exam.
Let's unpack the caveats. First, there is a lifetime limit of $35,000 that can be rolled over per beneficiary. You can't roll over 100 grand, just 35,000.
Second, the 529 account must have been open for at least 15 years. You can't open an account when Sally is 17 and roll it over when she is 18 just to bypass Roth rules.
Right. Third, the specific funds being rolled over must have been sitting in the 529 for at least 5 years. So no last minute super funding right before the rollover. Gary can't dump money in on Monday and roll it to a Roth on Friday.
Fourth, you can't just move the whole 35,000 in 1 year. The rollover is subject to the annual Roth IRA contribution limit.
Oh, so it takes a while.
Yeah. So if the Roth limit is $7,500, that means it would take several years to roll over the full $35,000.
Yeah.
And critically, the beneficiary must have actually earned income in that year to justify the Roth contribution.
Okay, those are the rules. But here is the gray area where most candidates lose points.
No.
I want you to think about this before we answer. Whose Roth IRA does the money actually go into?
Give them a beat to think.
Yeah.
So the money goes to the beneficiary's Roth IRA. Not the account owners.
Right. Panicked Paul cannot slide that 35 grand into his own retirement account just because he owns the 529.
Yeah.
It has to go to skater Sally's Roth IRA. And here is the craziest part. You know how Roth IRAs usually have income limits?
Right. The Magi phase out.
Yeah. Like if you make over a certain amount, the IRS says you are too rich to contribute to a Roth. Those income limits do not apply to the 529 rollover. So even if Sally somehow becomes a millionaire professional skateboarder at age 25 and her income normally bars her from a Roth, she can still receive that Roth rollover from her 529.
It is an incredibly powerful wealth building tool. It really takes away the primary objection clients have to 529s, which is the fear of overfunding the account and getting trapped by the penalty.
Absolutely. All right. So Panicked Paul has control, but he's stuck in these boring state-sponsored mutual funds. What if Paul is a day trader? What if he wants to take Sally's college fund and buy individual tech stocks or options or corporate bonds? Is he just out of luck with a 529?
He is out of luck with a 529 because 529s do not allow self-directed trading. But that perfectly transitions us to the other education account, the Coverdell Education Savings Account, or ESA.
Formerly known as the Education IRA. So I'm going to hit the imaginary buzzer here, ERR. All right, clear your brain of the 529. We're entering the strict, tiny world of the Coverdell. I like to think of the Coverdell as the 529's strict, highly restrictive sibling.
It really is.
The 529 was letting Grandpa Gary drop $190,000 in a single day. The Coverdell. The Coverdell is going to look at you with a magnifying glass and ask for your tax returns.
The contrast is stark, starting with the history and the contribution limits. Coverdells were created in the late 90s, and they never really got the legislative updates that 529s got.
Yeah.
So while the 529 has no federal limit, the Coverdell ESA has a tiny, strict contribution limit of $2,000 per year.
$2,000. In 2026, that barely pays for a single semester's worth of textbooks and a meal plan.
And here's the trick they will use on the exam. That $2,000 limit is per beneficiary, not per contributor.
Okay, let's play this out with our characters to see the mechanics. Think about this scenario. Grandpa Gary goes to the bank on Monday and opens a Coverdell for Skater Sally. He puts in $2,000. Panicked, Paul, not knowing Gary did this, goes to his broker on Tuesday and tries to put $2,000 into a separate Coverdell he opened for Skater Sally. What happens?
Think about the limit rule we just established. So the IRS rejects Paul's contribution or hits it with an excess contribution penalty if it somehow goes through. The limit is aggregate across all Coverdell, accounts for that specific beneficiary.
Okay.
Sally can only receive a total of $2,000 per year, regardless of how many wealthy relatives want to give it to her. They cannot both do it.
Paul and Gary are bumping heads at the doorway, but it gets worse for Paul because of the income limits. Remember how the 529 VIP club let anyone in? The Coverdell has a velvet rope based on your MGI. Let's define that. What makes modified adjusted gross income modified? Is it just my salary?
No, your adjusted gross income is your total income minus specific deductions. But to get your MGI, the IRS makes you add certain deductions back in.
Like what?
For example, if you took a deduction for student loan interest or foreign earned income, you have to add that back to your income to calculate your MAGI. It basically ensures that you can't use clever deductions to make yourself look poor just to qualify for this account.
And the phase outs for the Coverdell are brutal. For single filers, the ability to contribute phases out completely between $95,000 and $110,000 of MGI. For married couples filing jointly, the phase out is between $190,000 and $220,000.
So, if panicked Paul and his wife make $250,000 a year, he is completely locked out. He cannot contribute a single cent to a Coverdell.
But here is a fascinating workaround and a great way to understand how the rule is applied. The income limit applies strictly to the contributor, not the beneficiary, and not the parents of the beneficiary.
Exactly. So if Paul is locked out because he makes too much, what about Grandpa Gary? Let's say Gary has massive wealth, a $10 million net worth, but his actual taxable income for the year is only $80,000 because he's entirely living off municipal bonds and hiding his money legally in trusts.
Oh. Because Gary's MBGI is under the threshold, Gary can absolutely sneak in and make that $2,000 contribution for Sally. The IRS only looks at the tax return of the person writing the check, not the parents.
That is a brilliant deduction and totally something Gary would do. Okay, so we have tiny limits, we have income lockouts, but there is also a ticking clock with the Coverdell that does not exist with the 529.
Two ticking clocks, actually. First, you cannot contribute to a Coverdell after the beneficiary turns 18. The window slams shut on their 18th birthday. The only exception is for a special needs beneficiary.
And the second clock.
The money must be completely distributed by the time the beneficiary turns 30. Again, exception for special needs. But for Skater Sally, her 30th birthday is a hard, uncompromising deadline.
Okay, here is the scenario they will test you on. Sally turns 30. She still has $10,000 sitting in her Coverdell because she never used it. She's just letting it sit there in Apple stock. What does the IRS do?
Think about this. If I'm thinking about normal brokerage accounts, I'd assume nothing happens. It just keeps growing. But this is a tax-advantaged account. Does the IRS just confiscate it?
No, they don't confiscate it, but they force a distribution. At age 30, any remaining balance is forcefully distributed to Sally.
Because automatically?
Essentially, yes. Mm. And because it wasn't used for qualified education expenses, that distribution is treated as non-qualified. The earnings portion will be taxed as ordinary income, and it will be hit with a 10% penalty.
A ticking time bomb on her 30th birthday. To avoid this, Paul would have to roll that money over to another family member's Coverdell before she turns 30, maybe her younger cousin. Or he could roll it into a 529 plan, which has no age limits.
That's a crucial side-by-side comparison for the exam. The 529 has no age limit for contributions and no deadline for distributions. The Coverdell cuts you off at 18 and forces you out at 30.
So, hearing all this, tiny limits, strict income lockouts, age deadlines, why on earth would anyone use a Coverdell instead of a 529? Where is the silver lining?
It comes back to your earlier question about Panic Paul wanting to be a day trader. The primary advantage of a Coverdell is complete investment flexibility. We mentioned that 529 plans restrict you to the state's plan-selected mutual fund portfolios. You get a menu, you pick a track, and you're done. A Coverdell ESA is self-directed.
Ah, so Paul can take that $2,000, open a brokerage account, and trade individual stocks.
Exactly. He can buy Apple, he can buy Tesla, he can buy specific corporate bonds. If you were an aggressive, hands-on investor who thinks you can massively outperform a standard mutual fund, the Coverdell gives you the steering wheel to try.
And what about the expenses? Are they different?
They are very similar now, but with one key historical difference. Coverdells have always allowed tax-free withdrawals for K through 12 expenses. 529s only added that in 2017. And remember how the 529 has a $20,000 annual cap on K-12 withdrawals?
Yeah, you can't take out more than 20 grand a year for private high school.
The Coverdell has no such annual withdrawal cap for K-12. If you manage to grow the account large enough, you could withdraw $50,000 in 1 year for a private K-12 school from a Coverdell.
But logically, since you can only put in 2,000 a year, it would take a miracle stock pick to grow it big enough for that to matter anyway.
True, which is why the synthesis here, the takeaway for the exam, is that 529 plans are the default choice for the vast majority of families because of the higher capacity and lack of income limits. But you must know the Coverdell's specific restrictions, especially the age limits.
Okay, let's shift our perspective entirely. What if Grandpa Gary wants to give Skater Sally a massive stock portfolio, but he absolutely does not want it restricted to education?
Okay, completely different objective.
Right. He doesn't care if she goes to college. He wants to give her wealth, pure and simple, but she's only 12 years old. Enter the custodial accounts, UTMA and UGMA.
The Uniform Transfers to Minors Act and the Uniform Gifts to Minors Act. The fundamental concept here is that a minor cannot legally own securities or property outright. They can't sign a binding contract to open a brokerage account. So an adult must step in as a custodian.
So the account is literally titled Panicked Paul as Custodian for Skater Sally under the state UTMA. One custodian, one minor. You can't have joint custodians and you can't have multiple kids on one account.
Exactly. And here is the most heavily tested feature of a custodial account. It is what we call the drop it in the mailbox rule.
Okay, I love this analogy because it makes the legal mechanism so clear. When you take a letter and you walk up to one of those big blue USPS mailboxes and you pull the handle, drop the letter in, and let the handle shut, what happens if you change your mind 10 seconds later?
You can't get it back. It's a federal offense to break into the mailbox. The letter is gone. It belongs to the Postal Service now.
Exactly. And that is exactly how a gift to an UTMA or UGMA works. Gifts are irrevocable. The moment Gary transfers the stock into that account, it ceases to be his property. It ceases to be Paul's property.
It legally belongs to Skater Sally, the minor, is her social security number on the account.
The custodian is merely managing the property on behalf of the minor until they reach the age of majority.
Which leads to a lot of friction in these
Oh,
families.
for sure. So let's test this with a scenario. I want you to think about what the answer is here. Sally's UGMA account has grown to $50,000. On her 18th birthday, which is the age of majority in her state, she walks up to Panicked Paul and says, "Dad, I am cashing out the UGMA. I am buying a tricked-out van, I'm buying 50 custom skateboards, and I am following a band on tour for the next 3 years."
The ultimate Paul nightmare.
Right. Paul is horrified. Can Paul, as the custodian, stop her from taking the money? Pause and think.
Think about the mailbox.
Right. If it's the mailbox, the answer has to be an absolute unequivocal NO. Paul has lost all control. The custodianship terminates at the age majority.
Automatically.
The money is legally hers, and there are absolutely no restrictions on what she can spend it on. She can literally light it on fire.
This is exactly why Panicked Paul hates this account. It is the exact opposite of the 529 plan, where he held the keys forever. With a custodial account, the day she hits that age, usually 18 for UGA, sometimes up to 21 or 25 for UTMA, depending on the state, the money is hers to burn.
You brought up UGMA versus UTMA. The exam will expect you to know the difference between the two. Why are there two different acts?
It's a historical progression. UGMA is the older law. It was adopted by all 50 states originally, but it is very restrictive in what it can hold.
Like what?
UGMA permissible assets are limited purely to financial products, cash, securities like stocks and bonds, insurance policies, and annuities. That's it.
But wealthy people wanted to give their kids more than just stocks, so they created UTMA.
Exactly. UTMA is the newer law adopted by most states, and it is vastly more flexible. UTMA can hold basically everything. We're talking real estate, fine art, patents, royalties from a book, you name it.
That is where the test writers will try to catch you. They might ask you which account can hold a deed to an apartment building. It has to be in UTMA. UGMA cannot hold real estate.
Now, while Paul is managing this money before Sally turns 18, he has strict rules, right? He can't just treat it like his own day trading account.
Right. The custodian operates under a fiduciary duty. He must manage the account solely for the minor's benefit. He cannot use the assets for his own benefit. He can't take a loan from the account to fix his own roof.
And the exam loves to test what he can't do in the market. No margin trading, no borrowing money to buy more stock, no short selling, and no trading options. It must be straightforward, cash basis investing.
And there's one more restriction regarding how he can spend the money on Sally while she is a minor. He can use the funds for her benefit, like sending her to an expensive summer camp or buying her a car, but he absolutely cannot use the funds to pay for basic parental obligations.
Right. The things he is legally required to provide anyway. Food, basic clothing, shelter. He can't charge Sally rent to live in his house and pay himself out of her UTMA. The IRS will come down on him like a hammer for breaching his fiduciary duty.
Now, because this is an investment account that belongs to a child, we have to talk about how the growth is taxed. And this brings us to one of my favorite pieces of tax legislation, the kiddie tax.
The kiddie tax. This sounds like a joke, but it is a very real, very strict IRS rule. To understand it, we have to look at why they created it in the first place.
Let's do a deep dive into the history. Back in the 1980s, before this rule existed, what was Grandpa Gary doing?
Gary would realize that he is in the highest possible tax bracket, paying a massive percentage on his dividends and capital gains. Meanwhile, 5-year-old Sally is in a 0% tax bracket because she has no income.
I see.
So Gary would just transfer all his income-producing stocks into an account in Sally's name.
Income shifting. He lets the dividends pay out at Sally's 0% rate, completely avoiding his own high tax bracket.
Exactly. The IRS caught on to this massive loophole. To stop wealthy parents and grandparents from shifting unearned investment income to kids in lower brackets, they created the kiddie tax. And we have specific numbers for 2026 that you need to know for the calculation.
Let's break down the formula. It happens in three tiers. Let's say Sally's UTMA generates $5,000 in unearned income like dividends and interest this year.
The first tier is tax-free. The first $1,350 of unearned income is completely sheltered. Zero tax.
Tier two. The next $1,350. So from $3,151 up to $2,700.
That chunk is taxed at the child's rate, which is typically very low, often 0 or 10%, depending on the specifics.
Okay, so the first $2,700 is relatively safe. But what about everything above that? Tier three.
Anything above $2,700 is taxed at the parent's marginal tax rate.
Bam! The Gary loophole is completely closed. The IRS says, we don't care that the account is in Sally's name. If it makes more than $2,700, Paul, we are taxing it at your high tax bracket.
And who does this apply to? It applies to children under 18, or under 19 if they're not self-supporting, or if they're full-time students, it applies all the way up to age 24.
So even when she is in college, the kiddie tax haunts them. Okay, I have one more disaster scenario for Panicked Paul regarding the UTMA, and this is a huge gray area regarding financial aid that you have to understand.
This is critical for the exam, and it's something every financial advisor needs to know. When Sally fills out the FFSIS, the free application for federal student aid, she has to list all the family's assets to determine the expected family contribution.
Here is the problem. Because of the mailbox rule, the UTMA is legally Sally's asset. It is a student asset. And the AFSI formula heavily penalizes student assets compared to parent assets. Let's use a metaphor here. Imagine the AFIS as a brutal, steep hike up a mountain.
Okay, I like where this is going.
The UTMA is like a 100-pound heavy backpack that the student has to strap on. The government looks at Sally and says, you're a student, you don't have a mortgage, you don't have dependents. Therefore, you should spend almost all of your own money on your education before we give you a dime of federal aid.
Mathematically, the AFIS assesses student assets at a rate of 20%. Meaning, for every $100 in that UTMA, the government expects Sally to spend $20 of it on tuition that year.
20%. That is a massive hit. Now, compare that to a 529 plan owned by Paul. If Paul owns a 529 plan, the AFIS considers that a parent asset. In our metaphor, the parent asset is a backpack that the parent wears, and the government barely notices it because they assume the parent has to pay a mortgage, buy groceries, and save for retirement.
Parent assets are assessed at a maximum rate of 5.64%.
The difference is staggering. Let's run the numbers. If you have $50,000 in a UTMA, the FAFSA says, great, pay $10,000 toward tuition this year out of your own pocket. But if you have $50,000 in a parent-owned 529, the FAFSA says, okay, pay about $2,800.
Panicked Paul loses sleep over this. If financial aid is a concern, the 529 is astronomically better for eligibility than a UTMA or UGMA. You must remember those percentages. UTMA equals student asset, 20% hit. 529 equals parent asset, 5.64% hit.
That perfectly synthesizes the education and custodial accounts. Now, let's do complete pattern interrupt.
I'm ready.
Take a deep breath. We are completely leaving the classroom. We are leaving the mailboxes. We are walking through the sliding glass doors of a hospital. We need to talk about healthcare, and specifically the health savings account, or HSA.
The HSA is unique. In the entire United States tax code, the HSA is the only account that possesses what the exam refers to as the triple tax advantage.
It is a unicorn. It is the holy grail of tax accounts. But before we look at the magic of the unicorn, we have to look at the fence around it. You can't just decide you want an HSA because you think it sounds cool. There is a strict eligibility gate.
Right, they don't just hand these out to everyone. To contribute to an HSA, you must be enrolled in a high deductible health plan, an HDHP.
Mm.
If you have a traditional low deductible copay plan where you pay $20 to see a doctor and the insurance covers the rest, you are not allowed to use an HSA.
Let's explore why the government mandates this. Why tie this incredible tax break to a high deductible?
The government wants consumers to have skin in the game.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning, if you have to pay the first $2,000 of your medical bills out of your own pocket, you are going to be much more selective about going to the doctor for a minor sniffle.
Mm.
It reduces frivolous healthcare spending across the board. As a reward for taking on that high deductible risk, they give you the HSA.
And the IRS defines exactly what a high deductible health plan is for 2026. If you are on a self-only plan, your minimum deductible, the amount you have to pay out of pocket before insurance really kicks in, must be at least $1,700. And the maximum out-of-pocket limit is capped at $8,500.
If you are on a family plan, double it. Minimum deductible of $3,400 and a maximum out-of-pocket of $17,000.
Now, Panicked Paul hates high deductible plans because he hates uncertainty. He wants to know exactly what a doctor visit costs, but he loves tax breaks. So let's explain the triple tax magic that convinces him to sign up for the HDHP.
The three taxes you avoid. Number one, contributions go in pre-tax. If it comes out of your paycheck automatically, it lowers your taxable income immediately. If you contribute directly from your bank account, it is an above-the-line deduction on your tax return.
Boom. Tax advantage one. Tax-free money going in.
Number two, earnings grow tax-free. Just like the 529 or Roth IRA, you can invest the HSA funds in the stock market. You can buy mutual funds, ETFs, even individual stocks in some HSAs. And as it grows, you pay no capital gains taxes year over year.
Incredible. Tax advantage two. Tax-free growth.
Number three, qualified distributions are completely tax-free. If you use the money to pay for deductibles, copays, dental care, vision care, prescriptions, or even certain over-the-counter meds, no tax.
Tax advantage three, tax-free money coming out. Pre-tax in, tax-free growth, tax-free out. The triple tax unicorn. No other account does all three simultaneously. Traditional IRAs tax the withdrawal. Roth IRAs tax the contribution. Only the HSA dodges all three.
But there are limits on how much you can feed the unicorn. For 2026, a self-only plan allows a contribution of $4,400. A family plan allows $8,750.
And if Grandpa Gary is older, say over age 55,
he gets a catch-up contribution of an extra $1,000. However, there is a hard stop that the exam loves to test. You absolutely cannot contribute to an HSA once you are enrolled in Medicare.
Because Medicare is not a high deductible health plan. Once you have Medicare, you lose the eligibility to contribute, though you can still spend the money you already have in there.
Correct.
Okay, so that is the setup. Now, I want to present you with a massive gray area scenario. This is where people lose points because they don't understand the age mechanics. Let's look at two different withdrawals and you guess what happened.
Oh, okay. Lay it on them.
Panicked Paul has an HSA. He is 40 years old. He has a midlife crisis, withdraws 20 grand from his HSA, and uses it to buy a sports car, not a medical expense. Grandpa Gary also has an HSA. He is 66 years old. He also withdraws 20 grand to buy a sports car, also not a medical expense. How does the IRS treat Paul and how does the IRS treat Gary?
Think about the age difference here.
Right. What's the penalty for Paul?
Let's start with Paul at age 40. The IRS is going to punish him severely. Because he used the money for a non-medical expense before age 65, the withdrawal is added to his taxable income. POUS, he is slapped with a massive 20% penalty.
20%. That is twice as high as the penalty for early retirement withdrawals or bad 529 withdrawals. The IRS really, really wants you to keep this money for healthcare.
But Gary's situation is entirely different. Gary is 66. The rule states that after age 65, that brutal 20% penalty completely disappears for non-medical expenses.
Wait, let me make sure I'm hearing this right. Gary can buy the sports car with his healthcare money without the 20% penalty?
Yes. He still has to pay ordinary income tax on the withdrawal because it wasn't for a medical expense.
Yeah.
But there is absolutely no penalty.
Okay, let's unpack what this actually means in practice. If you are 65 or older, your HSA basically transforms. If you use it for medical, it's tax-free. If you use it for a sports car, you just pay income tax. What does that sound like?
It functions exactly like a traditional IRA for non-medical expenses after age 65.
It is a stealth retirement account. High net worth people like Gary use HSAs not just for doctor visits, but as a shadow retirement fund. They max it out every year, invest it in the S&P 500, and here is the ultimate hack. They pay out of pocket for their actual medical bills right now, and they keep the receipts.
Yep.
They let the HSA grow for 30 years. At 65, they have a massive pool of money. They can reimburse themselves for 30 years of receipts tax-free or just use it like an IRA for anything else. That is a brilliant piece of wealth management plumbing.
It's one of the most powerful strategies you can offer a wealthy client.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to finish up the HSA, the exam will almost certainly ask you to differentiate it from an FSA, a flexible spending account. They sound similar. They both deal with healthcare, but they operate on completely different rules.
Let's do a side-by-side comparison so it's super clear. Point one, portability. Who actually owns the account?
An FSA is tied to your employer. It is an employer benefit. If you quit, get fired, or change jobs, you lose the FSA. An HSA is portable. It belongs to you, the individual. If you leave your job, the HSA comes with you.
Point two, rollovers. What happens on December 31st?
The FSA is famously a use it or lose it account. You have to spend the money by the end of the year, or maybe a short grace period into the next year, or you literally forfeit the money back to the employer. The HSA rolls over indefinitely, forever. You never lose it.
Point three, investments. Can you grow the money?
You cannot invest FSA funds. They just sit in cash waiting to be spent on copays. You can invest HSA funds in stocks, bonds, and mutual funds to achieve long-term growth.
Point four, eligibility. Do you need a special health plan?
The HSA strictly requires that high deductible health plan. The FSA has no such requirement. You can use it with a standard low deductible plan.
If you can just remember that the HSA is yours to keep and grow, while the FSA is a temporary employer bucket, you will easily tell them apart on the exam.
So we have covered the Goliath 529, the strict Coverdell, the irrevocable UTMA, and the triple tax HSA.
It's time for the rapid fire recap. I'm going to throw out the concepts. Let's see if we can synthesize this perfectly. Here we go. Ownership. If I'm looking at a 529 plan, who holds the keys?
The account owner controls it, usually the parent. The beneficiary has no rights to it.
UTMA account?
The minor legally owns it. The custodian just manages it until the age of majority.
HSA.
The individual owns it, and it is completely portable.
Penalties. 529 or Coverdell non-qualified withdrawal.
10% penalty, but applied to the earnings only. The principal is never penalized.
HSA, non-medical withdrawal before age 65.
A harsh 20% penalty plus ordinary income tax.
Deadlines. Coverdell ESO.
It must be entirely distributed by age 30.
529 plan.
No age limit for contributions, no deadline for distributions.
No HSA.
No deadline. It rolls over forever.
Limits, Coverdell.
$2,000 per beneficiary, aggregate total across all contributors.
Tax benefits, the only account with a triple tax advantage.
The health savings account, pre-tax in, tax-free growth, tax-free out for medical.
Boom, that is the recap. Okay, as we wrap up, we like to leave you with a final provocative thought, something to chew on that connects these dry rules to the real world of wealth management. We touched on this earlier, but let's really blow it up.
Think back to the 529 to Roth IRA rollover rule we mentioned. For decades, 529s were thought of strictly as a way to pay for university tuition. But with this new $35,000 escape hatch to a Roth IRA, the entire strategy fundamentally changes.
It really does.
Imagine Grandpa Gary. He could open a 529 plan the day Skater Sally is born. He superfunds it with a massive lump sum, taking advantage of the gift tax exclusion. He lets it sit and compound for 15 years in the market. Sally turns 16, gets a summer job at a local skate shop, so she has earned income.
Because you must have earned income to do a Roth contribution.
Exactly. Gary can now start rolling money from that 529 directly into a Roth IRA for Sally. He is effectively bypassing the strict Roth IRA income limits and contribution source rules to kickstart a completely tax-free retirement fund for a teenager before she even finishes high school.
That's just wild.
Right. If that money compounds for another 50 years in a Roth, we're no longer just talking about education savings. We're talking about a completely new federally sanctioned vehicle for massive untaxed generational wealth transfer.
It just shows you how knowing the mechanics of these rules allows you to build completely different financial engines. You are not just memorizing trivia, you are learning how the plumbing of wealth actually works. You now have the tools, the rules, and the bizarre scenarios to completely dominate this material on the Series 65. Trust the logic, remember the traps, and you've got this. Keep diving deep, and we'll see you on the next one.